Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When U.S. troops withdrew from Iraq 3 years ago, things seemed hopeful. But recent conflicts in neighboring countries have destabilized the region, creating the right circumstances for the likes of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. The group entered Iraq at the start of the year, and since then, two Iraqi cities have fallen. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Baghdad today negotiating a new shared government there. With us now by phone from Baghdad is New York Times correspondent Sudad Al-Salahi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. How are you? Thank you for welcoming me. Happy to join you.
Thank you. How can the Iraqi government move fast enough to make the reforms sought by John Kerry?
Actually, John Kerry is trying to bring all the political leaders from all factions, Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurdish, to encourage them to sit together. The divisions were really deep among all of them recently, since last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to bring them together to try to find a solution to form the new government by excluding the suggestion to form a majority government as Maliki and his state of law coalition was planning to do. Now they are focusing on forming power-sharing government they used to do last 11 years. Because it sounds like majority government would exclude Sunnis and Kurdish, but if you bring all those factions together despite the results of election, then there is a chance to exclude the extremists and just to bring all the moderate opponents to participate in the political process in this new government. And it would be easy to target the ISIS and terminate them in a state of fighting all these sides. And Kerry is trying just to find a formula to make all sides satisfied with all what they're going to get.
Do you think that he has said if they can't do this fast enough that the United States will take some kind of action, airstrikes or some other kind of thing? Can they move fast enough to do anything meaningful before ISIS reaches Baghdad?
Actually, first of all, ISIS is their advance is stopped in a point. So
okay.
There is no major or significant movement toward Baghdad. This is first of all.
Okay.
Specifically after Sistani, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the most influential Shiite clerk in Iraq, calls to arm.
Mm-hmm.
So the security forces backed by Shiite volunteers and Shiite militias stopped their advance in specific areas, specifically near Samarra, and then near Samarra, southern northern Baquba, northern Maghdadiya, they stopped their advance. So there is no movement toward Baghdad so far. And ISIS is trying to just take control over the small towns that they left during the last few days. The second thing, yes, I believe that they can do it. You were asking about
Whether they can do
they
it.
They can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Can do it because the mainly things, logically, ISIS militants numbers are not really that big. We are not talking about thousands. We are talking about maybe hundreds. But because they have the required incubators, they have the other militants, Sunni insurgency from other groups like Islamic Army, Naqshbandiya Main Army, the other smaller groups, and even the tribesmen who joined them because of their anger against the Shiite-led government in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved so fast, and they took control over all these areas. They gripped these areas. Actually, the ISIS militants are fighting, but who is gripping the ground is the other factions, not ISIS. If they can make a deal with these groups, because those people have specific demands. They are angry. They are upset, not dissatisfied with all the policies that the government adopted last 11 years. So it's easy to exclude them, which means just give them what they want, make some concessions, and then you can just encourage them inside and incite them to join the political process, or at least to sit to negotiate and give them what they are looking for. Like most of them are looking to get to the Sunni region, so it is legal and constitutional demand. There is no problem with it. It's just because last few years all Shiites were against this demand, while at the beginning they were supporting this demand. So you can just sit and discuss this. But the problem is with ISIS, you have to deal with those people. You have to fight them because there is no way to sit and negotiate with them. They are not negotiating. They are looking just to kill more people, to grab more ground. But actually, without the support and the backup of the Sunni tribes in these areas, Mosul, Salah al-Din, and other areas, even in northern Diyala, they cannot do it.
They've split.
They cannot survive.
They've split off from al-Qaeda. What's the dispute? What's the difference between them?
Actually, it's like how we can say Al Qaeda is international organization, and they have how we can say general goal to create the Islamic rule or the Islamic Caliphate. But ISIS looks more ambitious. They are looking to create their specific area or emirate between Syria and Iraq. And just because this, they called it the Islamic state of Iraq and the Levant, or Iraq and Sham. But actually, you feel that they are aggressive, and they just want to be alone. Because even now, when they control these areas in Mosul, Salah al-Din, and northern Diyala, they issued what they called it the document of the city, or the paper of the city, where they announced that there is no flag, the right to be raised, but the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant flag. And no one has a right to discuss whatever they decided to do. And just because of this, the small problems just raised up. And now there is, in several areas, we witnesses fighting between Naqshbandiya and ISIS militants, and between Naqshbandiya and Islamic Army. But in other areas, they are their allies. They are fighting with them alongside, shoulder to shoulder with them. So the problem is ISIS is more aggressive and much more ambitious comparing to Al-Qaeda. And they don't believe that anyone else except them has a right to occupy any position to control the area, or except the Islamic rule that they believe, not the moderate Islam, the extremist Islam, has to be obeyed or has to be controlled on all these areas that they took control over it. And just because of this, I believe that the connection between them and their allies will be vulnerable soon. Next few days, I believe that we're going to witness serious problems between ISIS and other groups which allied with it during the last 3 weeks or 2 weeks.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Swarad Al-Salih. Sorry about that. She's a New York Times correspondent.
Okay.
If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. There are reports that life has actually improved for the people of Iraq. Well, that is where ISIS forces have taken over. Have you seen any evidence of that to give credence to that claim? Have you seen people returning to those towns?
People are complaining, actually, in these areas. Yes, I am in touch with people there, because we have many sources. And whenever we reach anyone, we ask him to put us with someone else. So it's like a network. You can create this network in these areas because you cannot be there physically. But people start complaining because there is serious shortage of gas, oil, electricity, and even food, basic food material, and medicine. So they start complaining because, yes, there is no government there to force them to do specific things. There is no soldiers or policemen to force them to obey specific rules. But there is those people who they cannot complain publicly because what they are doing or what they are forcing them to do. The new law that they are waived in the face of people saying that you have to submit to, like the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant law. So people start complaining. It's spread. Most of them, actually, this morning I was talking with people in Al Qa'im and in Rotba, where ISIS took control recently over these areas. They just start leaving, and they start leaving. Some of them leaving to Ramadi because there is no other way to leave to any other places. And the others they left to Nukheb, which means Nukheb in Karbala and Najaf.
Can you explain to us the difference between ISIS and ISIL? Why the two different names? One is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. The other one's the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant.
No, it is not. ISIS is not the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It is the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham.
Okay.
Sham, which means Syria, but other countries like Jordan and Palestine.
Okay.
Palestine. So it is some meat. Actually, it is just the brief, the first letters of the Arabic words of Dawlat al-Iraq, al-Dawla al-Islamiyya fi al-Iraq wal-Sham, or al-Dawla al-Islamiyya fi al-Iraq wal wa-Syria. We are taking just the first words of these four words, I from Islamic, S from state, and of Iraq, again I, and Sham or Syria, the first S from the last word. But Levant, some of our guys translated it to be the Levant, which means in Arabic Al-Sham, and others prefer to use the Arabic word Sham without translate it. That's all. There is no difference. It is the same. ISIL or ISIS.
And the idea of a separate Islamic state that they want to form, that would be crossing borders with Syria, Iraq, and what else?
Syria, Iraq, Jordan.
Yeah, Jordan.
Palestine. Yes.
Is that a remote possibility that that could occur?
I don't believe. I don't believe. First of all, if they find... how we can say, if they find opportunity to take control over many areas in Syria, because what happened there, and of course they took control over many areas in Iraq, because already Iraq is vulnerable since 2003, I believe that they cannot do it in Jordan or Palestine, because if you are talking about Palestine, it is Israel there, and despite the disagreement between the two sides, Palestinian and Israelian, they still have a stable country, okay? Jordan, it's also stable. But the problem is, those people are always taking advantage of the disagreement between the contents of the people. Like, they have to find something, like Shi'i Sunnis. And just because of this, they succeeded in Syria by encouraging Sunnis to uprise against Assad by saying, why the minority controlling you, why the minority govern the majority. In Iraq, the majority is Shiite, so they didn't say that why the Shiite govern Sunnis. No, Shiites oppress Sunnis, and they are targeting them, blah, blah, blah. So already the misleading or misguiding, or what you can say, the wrong policies that adopted by Assad's government and Maliki government also were really deepen this feeling that injustice inside people. Sunnis in Iraq felt for long years that they are targeted by Shiites because of this, the beatification law, which targeted mainly the Sunni Ba'athist leader and anti-terrorist item 4 law, which widely used against Sunnis, not because they are Sunnis, but because most militants came from this incubator, the Sunni incubator. But it seemed like for simple people, it seemed like Shiites are targeting them, or the Shiite led government targeting them. And just because of this, I feel blade game on these small things. Just emphasizes it and doubles the feeling inside people that they are targeted. Plus the big and serious mistakes that committed by the government, central government.
Mm-hmm.
People just were angered and were ready to deal or to feel that there is no way to change this but by or pick up their weapons and fight Shiite or fight the government. But the small difference between the anger Sunni people and ISIS is Sunnis have no problem with Shiites themselves. It's not about Shiites. It's about their demands. It's about what they believe that they have to get it. Mm-hmm. It's about their strife. But for ISIL, no, it is different. They see Shiites as disbelievers, so they have to be killed. There is no way to survive or to still alive.
Okay.
You are Shiite, then you have to be killed. There is no way to negotiate with you, to allow you to get anything, blah, blah, blah. And just because of this, there is always a hope to break this connection between ISIL and these incubators, the Sunni tribes or the Sunni armed factions.
Sudad, thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to join you, and thank you very much for you.
Sudad al-Salahi, she's a New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. Coming up, more conversation about Iraq and the U.S. role moving forward. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the crisis in Iraq today. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, forces have taken over large cities in Iraq and are expected to continue toward the capital city of Baghdad. U.S. Senator John McCain of Arizona echoed the concerns of his fellow Republicans in his call to maintain a U.S. presence in Iraq and in his criticism of President Obama for failing to do so.
Nowhere was the Obama administration's failure more pronounced than during the debate over whether to maintain a limited number of U.S. troops in Iraq beyond the 2011 expiration of the 2008 Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA.
Joining us in the studio is OSU historian and History Department Chair Peter Hahn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
His most recent book is Missions Accomplished, the United States and Iraq Since World War I. And also joining us in the studio is OSU political scientist and department chair Richard Herman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's good to be here.
If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Peter Hahn, let's talk a little bit more about where the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant come from, and or Sham, which stands for Syria. What does all of that mean? It's not about the lines drawn by the Europeans in the early 20th century.
ISIS essentially is a religious / political / military force that came into its current existence initially as part of the rebellion in Syria against the Assad regime. Given the political conditions in Iraq, they sensed an opportunity to extend their influence into that country as well. So now they have political influence, and they're on the military march in two places. And their dream, their ideological dream, is to establish a religious state based on their variation of Islam that would cross the international borders that presently exist. Those international borders, of course, a legacy of the Western imperial presence in the last century, and a legacy that they reject as being illegitimate. And so their dream is to build a political military state on their religious ideology and under their military control in a part of the world that they believe has an ill-fitting Western imperial legacy.
D- Did the Iraqi government not see ISIS or ISIL coming back at the beginning of the year? Why did it reach this stage? Richard Herman?
I think that it's been unsuccessful in Syria. We've seen, even with Obama not bombing Syria and the chemical weapons being dealt with a different way, Assad's hand in the last year has grown stronger. And also in Egypt, we've seen the Muslim Brotherhood just simply be smashed. The only place they have any chance is to retreat to the eastern districts of Syria and try to expand in the western districts of Iraq. I agree with the New York correspondent. As soon as they get to Baghdad, it's going to be a different story. And when they come up against real opposition among the Shia, it's going to be a different story. Or if they go into the Kurdish areas, I see what they've done is taken the easy pickings in a weak zone against weakly protected areas in the northern part of Iraq to the west. So, yes, this is a way to get a beachhead, but I don't think it's indicative of their great strength right now. I think rather it's the last 12 months has been Assad strengthening his hand and their support in Egypt simply collapsing. I also think it's very much with the New York correspondent is right. I think it's easy to exaggerate, and I believe John McCain has, their threat. Because if they do establish this beachhead, they're going to be surrounded by fierce enemies. They've not been successful in beating Assad in Damascus. I don't think they'll be successful in defeating the government in Baghdad. I think their supporters, the rich people in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, who've been playing with them, will see them as terribly threatening if they actually create an Islamic radical state that now, according to the Times this morning, will border Jordan. As well. I think they'll be surrounded by not only Saudi Arabia, Jordan, who will turn against them, Turkey will turn against them, obviously Maliki will fight them, and Assad will fight them. So it's not as if the picture for them going forward is all easygoing.
But to hear John Kerry speak, there's an imperative that the government reformulate itself, bring more balance to itself in order to avert more strikes by ISIS.
I agree with that completely. But then the 2006 bipartisan commission set up before the surge, long ago, It concluded as its first main point, the problem in Iraq is a lack of national reconciliation. It said it over and over again that the previous government under Jafari and now the current government back then under Maliki was not reaching out, not solving the issues of between the Sunni and the Shia.
Saddam Hussein as well, right?
Well, Saddam did it by just brutal violence.
Brutal force, right.
But since then, there's been no real agreement of the minds on what to do about Kirkuk, the distribution of oil revenues, the relationship between Shia and Sunni, a unified national army, a unified national police. And, you know, back then there were three alternatives. One that a lot of Shia believed in. These were irreconcilable, split the country, divide it. That was the Supreme Council of Islam. Ayatollah Hakim took that position. Some people in the United States, Leslie Gelb, Joe Biden, when he was a senator, also talked about maybe that, just give it up. Mm-hmm. The other view was that maybe under American tutelage and a lot of surge and we could stop the violence. Starting in 2007, and then buy space. And in that space, maybe Maliki would decide to become more more compromising, and they'd work out their differences. At least we'd buy them. But we bought them 6 years, 7 years. There's been no progress made on any of those political fronts. We did reduce the violence while we were there, but we didn't change any of the key political obstacles. And so now we're back pretty much right where we were. And will he become more reconcilable now because of John Kerry? I don't think so. I don't think that anyone in Iraq is going to make the kind of decisions they need to make until their backs are right to the wall and they're facing total crisis. And even then, they might not.
And you don't think this is the total crisis that'll make that happen?
Not yet. I mean, I think what this is going to do is produce sectarian divisions that is more likely to split the country apart.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Peter Hahn, you agree?
I agree largely with Professor Herman's assessment of some of the dynamics. I do see perhaps alternative paths since the discussion in 2006. Indeed, the Iraq Study Group's prescription, had it been tried, might have worked. President Bush decided instead to try the surge. He did buy 6 years, as Professor Herman suggested, for the Iraqis to figure out how to self-govern in a nationally unified basis and with reconciliation among the groups. Maliki has been the leader of that effort, and he has failed. And the burden is on him now to either find a better path forward or to step aside and allow his compatriots to find a better path forward.
Are the groups largely separated geographically, or are they throughout the country and just harken back to certain geographic histories?
At the time of the U.S. invasion, the three ethnic groups, cultural groups of Iraq, were generally divided by geography, although there had been considerable overlap by the migration of peoples during the Hussein regime and in previous decades. Part of the violence that accompanied the U.S. invasion was a separation of those populations, mass migrations, forced killings, forced departures, and so forth. So over the last 5 years or so, there has become a more pronounced geographical identity among the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shia. The Shia generally in the south, the Sunnis generally in the north and west, the Kurds in the north and northeast.
And the threats are affect different countries differently. The Kurds, the threat is to Turkey. You know, U.S. isn't just involved here on behalf of Iraq. It's a lot of it has to do with our relationships with other countries.
That's true. And one of the risks of an independent Kurdistan is it would upset other regional powers or upset the regional balance. Kurds live not only in Iraq, but also in Iran, in Syria, and in Turkey. And they are a sizable percentage of the Turkish population. The government of Turkey, which is a friend and NATO ally of the U.S., generally opposes the emergence of an independent Kurdistan because it's afraid that that would provoke separatism among its own ethnic minority and weighs against that as an outcome and might yet weigh in further against that prospective outcome should current events continue to evolve into a three-state solution.
It does feel like that game of dominoes that the Middle East is often described as.
Well, things are interconnected, and as Professor Hahn said, I think Turkey, as well as Saudi Arabia and Iran, have a lot of interest in what goes on in the future of Iraq. The current government of Turkey has actually worked out a pretty positive relationship with the Kurdish government of Iraq, or that province of Iraq. So I'm not sure they would be so opposed to seeing that autonomy continue now. Over the last 6 years or so, when we were there, and even since we've left, we set milestones that the Iraqis needed to reach in order to earn our continued support, and they've failed on almost every one of them. And it seems to me that going forward without a government that's committed to reconciliation, sending 275 American troops or 300 is just not going to do it. We had 150,000 plus for 7 years. It didn't have enough impact or any staying power. Because I don't think the people in Iraq have really decided what they want to do or faced the realities of what they're capable of doing without this American crutch. And of course, other players are involved in it also. But they are connected, but I think that's also to the American advantage. We're not the only country in the world that is worried about the future of Iraq. In fact, the threats there are much more serious to Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, Syria, of course, the Shia themselves, than they are to us. And I think the more they face those threats, the better it is will be for all of us.
What do we know about how ISIS is being funded, where the money's coming from? I've heard different numbers, too. Sudat al-Salahi from the New York Times said that it's been exaggerated, their numbers, and that they're really in the hundreds. I've read different numbers, at least 10,000, and very well supported financially.
They've enjoyed quite a bit of support from wealthy people in the Gulf, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. They've robbed banks, and where they have established control, they've imposed taxes and protection rackets, and they are not insufficient. I mean, they're funded from their own indigenous sources in that regard. They have had a lot of foreign support. As I mentioned earlier, there's no place in Egypt any longer if you want to be a jihadi. If you want to be an international jihadi, the place to go is to ISIS. And so if you're Chechen or somewhere Southeast Asian or other kinds of Muslims who wants to get into the mix, and they enjoy that support from all over those areas. As I say, I think it's exaggerated how much money and material they have, but I think their external support has been pretty clear.
As far as their numbers, some of the initial reports probably exaggerated their numerical strength, and those reports were based on the rapidity of the surge of ISIS influence over the last couple of weeks. What seems to be emerging now in the media accounts, including the one from your New York correspondent this morning, is that ISIS is actually small in number. The recent surge in the north and west of Iraq was sustained by local Sunni tribes who had grievances against al-Maliki and formed a short-term partnership with ISIS in order to deliver a message to al-Maliki. Looking forward, I would suspect that if the situation stabilizes, then that coalition among the moderate Sunni tribes and ISIS would disintegrate, and they would start contesting each other for control of that part of the state. That also points to the limits of ISIS and emphasizes the view that it doesn't really pose an existential threat to Baghdad per se, or to the heart of Iraq as traditionally defined.
We have to say goodbye to Richard Herman now. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Richard Herman's political science professor and department chair at Ohio State University. Coming up, we continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the crisis in Iraq this hour. Still with us is OSU historian and department chair Peter Hahn. His recent book is entitled Missions Accomplished: The United States and Iraq Since World War I. Thanks again for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Joining us now by phone from the University of Chicago is political scientist and the director of the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, Robert Pape. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I heard a joke that if there's one thing the Sunnis and the Shias in Iraq can agree on, it's that they don't want U.S. interference. Is there any truth to that?
Actually, I think increasingly that's what we're seeing. What we have seen is that the Shia government is very reluctant to do almost anything that the Obama administration has asked, which is pretty similar to what the Bush administration was asking at the end of in its last years. For years, we have been asking the Shia government to be more inclusive, and in fact, what's happened increasingly over the last couple years is that they have been more exclusive, and what we are now witnessing are the results of that, which is essentially a Sunni revolt. And the Sunnis that are in revolt, coming from multiple groups, ISIS plus other nationalist groups, are really quite loath to work with the Americans. There was a portion of that of those Sunnis who a few years ago weren't working with us exactly tightly, but at least a bit, called the Anbar Awakening. But I suspect that since we did nothing to stop the Shia from essentially crushing that movement in the last few years, that even they would be quite reluctant, at least in the near term, to work with Americans.
Why the resistance to inclusiveness? I guess, Peter Hahn, could you address that? Why, if they see what the benefits are of inclusiveness, why the exclusivity? Is it just always a matter of getting back at?
With regard to al-Maliki?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's just a traditional form of politics. It's a power struggle. He was elected and to the office. He put together a coalition to sustain that power, and he decided to exercise a form of power that was based on an old-fashioned corrupt cronyism. That does not make him unique among leaders of the Middle East. It does not make him unique among leaders of the world. He decided the best way to protect his own interests and the interests of the people about whom he cared the most was to exercise a form of power that was based on his friends, on his sectarian group, on his allies, rather than taking chances and making compromises and incurring the risks that would have been necessary to build a truly national, integrated, intersectarian government.
And I would also add, I think that in the recent past, the Shia, and not just Maliki, but probably quite a few of his supporters, harbor a fair bit of resentment for against the Sunnis, because for many decades before we toppled Saddam, it was the Sunnis who were effectively running the Shia. And the Sunnis were a minority. They were our ally for many decades. And the when we toppled Saddam, we essentially toppled the Sunni government that was running Iraq. And so it was quite natural that then the Shia, the larger Shia group, would end up becoming the new government. And also, I'm afraid, natural that they would have a fair bit of resentment for the Sunnis. But that said, I think that the fact is the Shia government, Maliki and others, have a fundamental choice staring them right in the eye at the moment, which is if they continue to pursue the policy of exclusiveness, this is going to break Iraq apart. If they want to hold on to an integrated Iraq, then some inclusiveness is going to be necessary.
Are there any elements in Iraq that could take could shoulder this task of inclusiveness now? Or is it going to fall to someone like Maliki, even though it's not part of his personal political matrix?
Well, what we saw last week, there were some Sunnis and Kurds and others who met with Maliki, and this did not get off the ground last week. But I think the answer is possibly. And the reason is because this group that I mentioned that became what's called the Anbar Awakening, this is a group of Sunni tribes in Anbar. This is a group of nationalists, former Saddam loyalists, who really don't share a lot in common with this group called ISIS, which is a far more hardline religious Islamic group. And that, when we were working with the Anbar Awakening from 2006 to 2008, this effectively split the Sunnis away from the terrorist group, and many of them even fought battles with the terrorist group. Now, they weren't our little army doing this. They weren't fighting for America or Washington. They were really just fighting for their own local independence. And I think that we could restart policy, this policy, this would be, I think, our best approach for the future, but it's one that's going to take some time. This is not going, given how we basically stood aside as Maliki crushed the Anbar Awakening in a whole variety of ways, this will take a couple of years to regenerate, but the seeds of it are actually there, because again, I think that a large fraction of the Sunnis simply are not up for ISIS's broader goals.
Peter Hahn, we were talking about how, in a way, the thesis, antithesis, synthesis process of political, the political dynamic there, where these groups coalesce to fight the larger enemy and then fall apart after the enemy is, whether it's the government leadership or whatever it might be, has gone on for time immemorial. It's a classic revolutionary dynamic. It didn't seem to happen in the United States. What's the difference? Why can't there be revolution and change in Iraq that we knew here?
Well, looking at the long course of history, there is a typical model of revolutionary change in which a dictatorship or a monarchy or a corrupt regime of some sort is overthrown by a coalition of its opponents. And then from the moment the original regime is overthrown, the coalition factionalizes, breaks apart, starts infighting, and there's a cycle of violence and turmoil that follows until someone emerges as the new top dog. To a certain degree, that's what's happened in Iraq, or what could be happening now. And one can find a variation of that model in many different national settings over many centuries of time. Now, there have been some examples of peaceful revolutionary change, or more peaceful revolutionary change. The American Revolution of the 1770s and 80s. Perhaps one example, after the violence used to oust the British Empire, the Americans generally held it together and worked out their internal differences by peaceful parliamentary moves and did not engage in a brutal type of infighting. The gradual British Revolution against monarchical rule and the emergence of democracy maybe is another example. But in France, the model of violence pertained, again, as it did in many other places. And that, again, seems to be what might be happening in Iraq, especially if we get to a point where al-Maliki is ousted and then the forces arrayed against him begin to disintegrate, the coalition begins to disintegrate, and they battle each other, which is what I would expect to happen.
John McCain said that the first step to progress is ousting Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Is that option viable, Bob Pape?
Well, I think that it shows the extent to which American political leaders are used to some micromanaging and controlling local politics, and that's part of the reason why there's so much resentment and animosity toward Americans around the world. I think that the Obama administration has tried to nudge in this direction. That is, they've tried to offer vocal support for alternatives to Maliki. But I think that the idea that we should go in and literally, like a puppet master, pull the strings and then control who, pick who the next leader is to be our leader in Iraq, would only turn the Shia against us as well. I think that the fact is that we should be arguing to the Shia a little differently. We should say they have a fundamental choice in front of them. Either Iraq will break apart with their continued exclusive policy, and they have to accept the consequences of Iraq breaking apart, which means a strong, increasingly strong Sunni state immediately as their neighbor that will be their enemy, or change to a more inclusive policy that promises more somewhat, certainly more benign politics in the medium term. And I think that is our best approach, because otherwise, if we stick our noses too far down this, get our fingers too much in the pie and actually try to control the outcome, then we will be essentially making an enemy of all the groups.
Peter Hunt?
Yeah, I think it's a given in international diplomacy that generally there's often the case that you want to intervene in the internal politics of another state. And one could make the case that in this situation, the U.S. would want to. It would want to take charge. It would want to bear influence. It would want to ease Maliki out and bring in someone more committed sincerely to a policy of reconciliation. On the other hand, one cannot pose as an intervener, or one provokes a natural sense of nationalism-based opposition from the people of the country who feel that you're unjustly mixing it up in their internal affairs. So the right approach might be to work quietly behind the scenes without getting caught, so to speak, without public fanfare, and seeing if circumstances can be arranged in such a way that a peaceful transition of the governing authority of Iraq is accomplished in a way that does not have the fingerprints of Uncle Sam all over it.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney has claimed that we have created a vacuum in the Middle East that is now being filled by these extremist groups. Let's listen.
We create a vacuum and it's being filled. And today it's being filled by Sisi from Syria. It's being filled by their attempt, obviously, to take over all of Iraq. But it's also being filled by places like Pakistan, where the Taliban have just launched a major attack on the Karachi airport.
Is that we created a vacuum? Is he talking about the United States necessarily, or?
I think he's trying to blame the Obama administration. But what I would say is, so I've been debating various people about whether we should topple Saddam Hussein from the mid 1990s on. So even though most of the public didn't focus on the issue of toppling Saddam until after 9/11, and then of course when we did it in 2003, this has been a subject of very intense debate debate with not just professors, but in the NSC, the Clinton administration, and before we got anywhere near to doing it. And the main benchmark, that is the default consequence that was always likely to be the main result, was of toppling Saddam, was breaking Iraq into three pieces. And the reason is because what Saddam was an awful, brutal dictator, and he used his brutality to suppress the nationalist leanings of the Shia and the Kurds. That's why he was so brutal. Well, that also kept Iraq together. And that brutality served America's oil interests by having Iraq continue for some years to provide oil. And the fact is, by toppling Saddam, we were always likely to unleash a three-sided nationalism that was going to be incredibly difficult to control. Now, if we kept 150,000 troops there for 40 years, well, maybe we could suppress it. But the fact is, we were never likely to be able to keep a heavy presence there for decades and decades.
And ultimately, even after 40 years, Saddam was in power for a long time. Peter Hahn, I mean, is there anything, can you suppress anything forever?
Suppressing the power of Saddam?
Not the power of Saddam, but as soon as his government was toppled.
Forces.
Right, right.
Well, the toppling of Saddam did unleash what seems to be the centrifugal forces that are pulling Iraq apart. Indeed, Saddam kept a lid on those pressures and through sheer brutality forced the country to remain unified. I do think it's theoretically possible to see Iraq emerge as a modern state on an intersectarian basis. That, to me, does not seem to be an absolute dead letter from the outset. That doesn't mean it's a given. That means that there has to be careful planning and careful execution and maybe a sheer amount of good luck. A happy outcome would depend on the independent decision-making of various Iraqi factions and individuals, and that's something that Western powers simply cannot control. But if the situation is played well, the game is played skillfully, and a few breaks are caught, those forces that seem to be tearing Iraq apart could be neutralized, and Iraq could remain a single unified state. I don't think that's yet has to be determined to be out of the question.
Robert Pape, you wrote recently that American military reengagement in Iraq would lead to a resurgence of anti-American suicide terrorism. What you mean, like the road bombs and that sort of a thing, or what?
No, I'm more directly worried about threats here at home.
Okay.
Shortly after 9/11, I compiled the first complete database of all suicide attacks around the world. I focused on suicide attack because 9/11 wasn't just a terrorist attack. It was a suicide attack. Without the element of suicide, the 19 hijackers could never have killed 3,000 people that day. And what I noticed after 9/11 is we didn't have a good database of suicide attacks around the world, a global database. We had global databases of ordinary terrorist attacks, but not specifically suicide attacks. So then when I put that together, a lot of governments, our government was very interested in this. The Pentagon was very interested in this. They allowed me to start my center, the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, even though the main finding cut strongly against some of the policies that we were pursuing at the time. Because my first database showed that half of the suicide attacks from 1980 to 2003 were not carried out by Islamic fundamentalist groups. The world leader at that time was the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, a Marxist secular Hindu group. Mm-hmm. What over 95% of suicide attacks had in common was a strategic goal, which is to respond to a foreign occupation and to launch attacks to get the occupier out. That allowed me to predict that if we went and conquered Iraq and occupied it, we would unleash the largest suicide terrorist campaign in modern times. I published this in the New York Times in September 2003, and in fact, that's what happened. And we not only had 1,000 suicide attacks in Iraq in the coming years, but we also had the Madrid bombings. We also had the London bombings. That is, we had attacks against the military allies of the United States in order to cause, in this case, Spain and Britain, to withdraw their combat forces from Iraq. And right now, ISIS has not targeted America. It has not targeted Europe.
Well, we have to end it there. Robert Pape, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to do it.
And also Peter Hahn from OSU, thanks to you.
You're quite welcome, Ann.
Justin English produced this program. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher.